organizers of this nice workshop. Unfortunately, I was not able to enjoy it as much as I would have liked to. I couldn't get out of all the commitments from campus, so stuck in classes and committee meetings, preventing me from being here. Anyway, so okay, so let me. So what I will talk about today is a few problems that involve dynamic task-based coordination of mobile robotic networks. So we are going back to the engineering and this warming by design aspect of this workshop. Before I start talking about the these technical issues, I would like to acknowledge my collaborators. Here at UCLA, Andrea Bertossi and my students, John and Wright, Chan Xie, Marco Pavone, and my postdoc, Alessandro Arzie, collaborators at Santa Barbara, Francesco Bullo, and his student, Stefan Savla, and former colleagues at Illinois, Petros Bulgaris, and my student, Vikram Shah. Okay, so what is it that we want to do? Now, this comes at the end of the week, so probably you have seen this kind of stuff a few times now. Anyway, so the whole motivation is this, that we see that, we notice that large group of animals exhibit these sophisticated collective behaviors that arise from, you know, most likely for very limited information from local international groups, okay? And these collective behaviors most likely arise from individual goals and limited ability to exchange information. Okay, so just the emergence of this complex collective behavior is something that is very fascinating and something that a lot of people have been doing research on for a while. Today, we are able to build robots that are much cheaper, smaller, can do more things. So we can actually think of building large-scale teams of swarms of robots. And this has motivated a growing interest from the robotics and controls communities to design motion coordination algorithms and make sure that they are scalable to large, such large groups. Okay. So most of the research efforts have been devoted to understanding how you can design these interaction rules that kind of recreate something that looks like what happens in nature, okay? So this is something that, you know, has been done either for understanding the biology of these animal groups, but even for computer animations. So you go watch the Lord of the Rings, and then you have these battles of epic proportions, and then you have all these thousands of orcs moving around. I mean, you don't want to have, you know, thousands of extras in doing these battles, okay? So that's something that is done in computer graphics. In the controls community, I would say that a lot of people have been concentrating on designing decentralized algorithms to achieve some basic tasks. So, for example, formation flight, rendezvous, deployment. And, you know, the key point there was to make sure that these algorithms are scalable to large groups in the sense that they're, for example, the time complexity or the number of the amount of information that you have to transfer across the network doesn't grow too quickly. But a question that is very interesting for me is, and has not been addressed that much, at least to my knowledge, is why would you want to have these worms? Okay, so we have worms in nature, and animals have lot of reasons for swarms. Okay, but if I had to build airplanes or robots or something, so why should I build, you know, 100 airplanes and let them fly together? You know, that just looks. It's a big problem, and I'm not sure what I'm getting out of it. Okay, so usually, you know, there are arguments that go as follows. So this is being done by biological systems, so it must be good for something, right? But it's not very compelling. Other arguments are, you know, they say, okay, large-scale systems offer, you know, graceful performance, degradation, robustness to failures, redundancy. Okay, which is a reasonable argument, but okay, so let's say that I want to take a picture of some place, so I send one airplane. The airplane might fail and might crash, so I send two airplanes. Okay, so my probability of getting the picture increases. Okay, but by how much? By something, but then I send three, then I send four. I mean, how much am I getting more in terms of reliability in terms of how much my bill is increasing. I mean, fuel and just the cost of the airplanes. So really, this is not really a strong argument for really large groups. Okay, so I can understand having two or three airplanes, but not having 100 airplanes to go and take one picture. Okay, so what are the probability that 99 fail? Okay, so you get very small marginal returns. Okay, so the question is, which I think that we should really understand why we want to deploy large robotic teams, and we need to understand if there are any fundamental benefits associated to large scale networks. Okay, this is for large scale man-made networks. So I have to find a reason why I would like to fly 100 airplanes as opposed to just one airplane. Okay, so then the questions are, you know, some of the questions that you might ask are the following. So are there any tasks that are better suited to large teams? What are the advantages of numbers? And you know, the opposite question, are there some applications in which actually having more airplanes is actually going to hinder you? I mean, probably, I don't know if you have noticed, but if you try driving around you know, Los Angeles at the rush hour, you know, the idea of having this huge number of robots or cars or airplanes moving around is not that attractive. So then if you look at this, then you know, the ultimate question is the following. So given a task, so can we select what is the most appropriate size of our team in such a way that they can accomplish the task in the most efficient way? Okay. So I think that this all leads to something that I refer to as the as a subject that is the algorithmic analysis of multi-edge and mobile systems. What we want to do is really understand how the complexity, the cost, but and also the performance scales as the number of agents changes, so that I can, you know, choose the right size of my robotic team based on some quantitative reasons. Okay, not just because I want to fly 100 airplanes because I just look. So this is the first problem that I will be addressing, and this is something that Francesco Bullo already showed a few days ago. It's a very scholarly name, this department problem. But you know, it explains more than, you know, I could call it this dynamic task-based coordination. doesn't leave the same impression. But anyway, so the problem is as follows. So I have some kind of process that generates these targets, okay? I mean, you can think of them as food, okay? So there's some process in the environment that generates this food, okay? Then I have a bunch of agents, which are represented by this tagline, and they are subjected to some, you know, constraints on their dynamics. So for example, they might have bounded velocity, bounded speed, or, you know, bounded maneuvering ability, so on and so forth. And what they want to do is, you can formulate different objectives, but you know, something that is very natural for the individual Pac-Man here is they want to eat as much food, okay? For example, per unit time, which also means as much food as possible per unit energy that you are spending just moving around, okay? Or you just want to make sure that you get more food than other guys, okay? Other applications are the following. So if you remember, for example, in Vijay Kumar's talk, what he had is, he had a bunch of, in this, you know, find the student terrorist application. What he had is, he had a bunch of UAVs that were circling very high, okay, and they spotted the student wearing the orange jacket, right? But they spotted the student kind of in a very rough manner, okay? So they said, I think that I saw something orangish, you know, pretty much, in this region. So then what he had like a bunch of ground robots that had to move to that location to get an exact fix on the position of the terrorist or the identity of the terrorist. Okay? So think of this as something similar. So let's say that, for example, we have some satellites or some very high altitude airplanes, and they're looking at things happening on the ground, and they have some hint that maybe something is going on in this area. Okay, and or maybe you have soldiers on the ground, okay? Or you can think of this as an environmental monitoring application. So let's say that you have a sensor network that monitors the temperature in a forest, okay? And this sensor network, you know, is made of very cheap thermometers. They can give you a false positive, okay? So a sensor might fail and say you know, you have a high temperature here, this may be a fire. So then what you might want to do is send somebody to investigate, okay, and go on location and get some more precise measurements. Okay. So you have all these targets are something that you can think of service requests. So for example, this can be, you know, just please take a picture of this location, or you know, please come and fix my my dryer or my washing machine. And then you have a fleet of you know, technicians driving around in vans. Okay, or it can be food items in a foraging situation. Threats to investigate in a military application or a security application, so where you have airplanes flying around. Another application is possibly the essentially providing network connectivity via mobility, that is where all these targets are actually information packets that need to be picked up and then delivered somewhere else. Okay, so let's look a little bit at the mathematics of this, the problem formulation. So what I do is I model this target generation by a stochastic point process. It's a special temporal process. In particular, we use a Poisson process, even though the, you know, the Poisson assumption just makes the calculations easier. It's not really needed. Okay. So this Poisson process is parameterized by, so I have a temporal intensity lambda, that is the number of events that appear on average per unit time. And then whenever a new target has been generated, it is generated in a specific point in the environment according to a special distribution phi. And you know, you can look at different variations. This, if lambda is zero and you just have an initial distribution, that's just a static problem, okay? Or you can have a dynamic case in which lambda is non-zero, and then you can also have uniform or non-uniform special distributions. Anyway, so if you want to summarize this whole thing, if you take a subset of your region and then you want to look at the expected number of targets generated in the subset in a time interval of length t, and this number would be lambda times t, times the integral of your spatial density over your region of interest. Okay? So then we have m agents, which I'm really interested in agents with non-polynomial dynamics, that is, non-integrable constraints on their dynamics, okay, on their velocity. We look at models that are known as, in particular, today we look at Dubin's car. This is something that essentially, the way we model it is something that can always move at unit speed and can move on paths with bounded curvature, okay? So think of it as a model for an airplane, okay? So it cannot stop, has to keep going, and can turn only with some bounded curvature. But you know, this is also extendable to other models that I will not mention today. We assume that all vehicles are identical and have unlimited target service and capacity, that is, they don't need to come back to a depot to refuel, for example, they just can keep going forever. We want to devise a control policy that achieves two objectives. First of all, we want to make sure that the number of outstanding targets doesn't blow up, it doesn't diverge. So I want to keep that fine. And also, what I want to do is, given that this is kept to a finite number, what I want to do is I want to make this number as small as possible. Okay, that means I also want to make to minimize the expected waiting time between the appearance of a target and the time it is visited by one of the vehicles. Okay. By the way, there is this very, very well-known formula in tuning theory that relates the average number of outstanding targets to the expected waiting time through the time intensity of the Poisson process. Okay. So essentially, what we have to do is this policy can really has. Be split into two components. One is the component of task assignment. So I have to decide, given a particular target, which one of my agents should go and service it. Okay, and then we have a path optimization policy, which determines what is the best sequence in which you should visit targets, and then what is the best path to go through them. Okay, of course, we cannot have access to future events, but we can have a model of the process. Okay, so this is a little bit of a roadmap to the the analysis and design process that we will follow. You will see that we will start from the one single vehicle case, okay, and then we will move on to the multiple vehicle case, the swarming situation. So I will ask you to bear with me while I go through the single vehicle case, because we need to look at what happens in the multiple vehicle case. There is some previous work on the Euclidean case, where essentially was most of the data were obtained by Dimitri Bersimas, who is an operational research professor at MIT and with his students in the early 90s. And what they did is they analyzed this problem into two asymptotic cases, the case in which the target generation rate is very small, and the case in which the target generation rate is very high. Okay, and what they did is they obtained lower bounds for both these cases, and you will notice that the lower bound in the light load case is something that is related to the geometry of the region, okay, and the number of agents. So this is something that is called the continuous Weber function or the multimedian function. Essentially, this is the selection. So this is minimized when you pick these points in P in such a way that they minimize the expected distance to the next sample from a certain distribution. Okay? So that's called the median of this. And also then they have some results for the heavy load. But let's see what we can do in terms of design. Okay, so now we want to design something that is implementable in a decentralized way. So the very first thing that you can do is, you know, the most obvious strategy in a sense is just a greedy strategy. Okay, so just go visit the target that is nearest to you. Okay, and just keep doing it. And we are actually doing with a single agent case. This is okay. This is an okay strategy. It's a log n approximation to the best thing that you can do. That is the traveling salesman optimal traveling salesman tool. It gives a constant factor approximation to the optimal performance in the dynamic case, even though this is something that has not been proven. So we propose another strategy that is we call the single vehicle residual horizon (SRH) strategy, which works as follows. Instead of going towards the nearest target, what you have to do is go towards the densest cluster, okay? The densest cluster containing at least a fraction eta, where eta is a parameter that between 0 and 1. Okay, so go towards the densest cluster and then visit all the targets in that cluster in an optimal fashion. Okay? If there are no targets, and you keep doing this in a receiving horizon way. If there are no targets, just move to the median of your own region. Okay? And then we can prove that this is something that has this performance here. You will notice that the performance increases as eta, this parameter eta, that measures the length of your horizon, goes to 0. Okay? So essentially, this parameter eta measures your reactiveness, okay? How much responsive you are to changes in the environment.
Other parameters? One's beta,
good point. I think that I don't have. Okay, so there is this, I forgot to include that equation in the slide.
So
okay, so that parameter beta is a, so there is this result that is due to Burswood, Hutton, and Hammersley in the late 50s, I think, that relates, that essentially gives a deterministic limit on the cost of stochastic traveling salesman tools, okay? So essentially, what the result says is, maybe I can write here, is that the limit as n goes to infinity of the shortest traveling salesman through n randomly sampled points, say in a unit square, over the square root of n, is equal to this beta part. Okay?
And you're better than the traveling salesman. That means you're better or worse? Or?
No, okay, so this is a slightly different problem because this is a dynamic problem. So the traveling salesman problem is you're given all the points at the beginning and then you just have to follow an optimal path through them.
Mm-hmm.
What we have here is new points that keep appearing.
Okay.
So something that you could do is wait a very long time until you have a zillion points and then compute an optimal tour through them. This will minimize your fuel expenditure, for example, but will not make your customers very happy. Okay. So what you want to do is as soon as you have a call, maybe from the customer, you might want to kind of optimize your path, but you don't want to keep him waiting too long. So this is a slightly different problem. Of course, actually what happens if this parameter eta is equal to 1, then what I do is at time 0, I look at all the points, all the targets, and I compute the traveling salesman, I solve the traveling salesman problem, and do it. and I just don't look at new targets appearing in the environment. Okay, then when I finished servicing the targets that were the original time, I open my eyes again and repeat the process. Okay, but actually you can improve the performance essentially by a factor of two by having a shorter time horizon. That is, okay, let's service the densest cluster now. When I'm done, let's open the eyes again and look for the next densest cluster. Okay? And that actually, in the limit where eta goes to zero, this is actually the best known, the performance of the best known policy for this problem, okay? Best known centralized.
So does the eating process itself, this is with one agent?
This is for one agent, so I ask you for some patience. So we'll get to the multiple agent case. Okay? So let me show you, so this is the nearest neighbor policy, okay? Which is a reasonable policy, works kind of well. But you will see that essentially this vehicle here will spend a lot of time in regions that are kind of empty of targets, okay? That makes the average cost per target very high, okay? Whereas in this other simulation, I'm doing this residual horizon policy where I go for the densest cluster. And you see that essentially this vehicle is always shooting for the regions where the targets are tightly packed. That means that makes the average cost per target very small.
There's something weird about the regeneration rates are different.
The parameters are different. Yeah, and the vehicles also are different. Pac-Man is electric. So the parameters are not the same. But you know what you should notice is that this one never spends any time in regions that have kind of like a low density. Okay, because essentially what you know is that if you wait long enough, the low density region will no longer be low density. Okay, so if you wait long enough, the cost of servicing those targets will be lower on average.
How do you determine density?
Oh, very good question. So the way I do it is actually the following. So look at, remember that we are shooting for the densest cluster, okay? And there is a very effective way of looking for clusters that is what is called the Kruskal's algorithm for building the minimum spanning tree. Okay, so essentially the way you build a spanning tree is by looking, for example, the two closest targets, okay? And then you add an edge there. Okay? And then you keep growing this thing always by adding the shortest edge. And then what you do is you build a bunch of clusters. As soon as you hit one of your clusters contains the required number of targets, that's the densest cluster with that number of targets. Okay? So it's a simple polynomial time algorithm.
So does this simulate a Levy process? Is that because it has these large jumps and then sort of random movement inside the clusters?
I never thought about it that way. Honestly, I don't have an answer.
The other question I had was, does it use, it will go to the largest cluster independent of how far away it is from it?
Yeah. Yes, because you know the fact is that in the limit where the number of targets is very high, then the cost of just moving somewhere else in this region is bounded by a constant, right? Whereas the cost of servicing a bunch of targets, that goes to infinity. So essentially the cost of moving to some other part in the region is negligible. Okay, so you don't care about that. Okay, so this is what is wrong with this one. Okay, so you don't really care about the closest target, you just want to make sure that you eat a lot of food in a very short time when you get there. Okay, essentially you're minimizing your average cost per target. Okay, so being greedy. Okay, so this was for the single vehicle case. What do we do in the multiple vehicle case? Now, let me just show you this this policy here, and then I will explain why I'm doing this. So essentially what we do is we associate to each agent a virtual generator. So we extend the dynamics of this agent. Okay? We just associate to each one of them a virtual generator. So in a biological setting, you can think of it as the nest. Or some, you know, the home of this. So some place or some feature that determines what is the territory of that particular agent. Okay. Then what we do is we build a Voronoi partition generated by all these virtual generators. Okay. Then what I will do is the following. Each vehicle will just execute the single vehicle residual horizon policy within its own Voronoi region. Okay. But at the same time, you would like to move your generator in such a way that your region becomes more and more favorable to you, in a sense. Okay, and the way you do this is the following. Essentially, here you go down the gradient of that continuous Weber function. So essentially, you're trying to minimize the expected distance to the next generated target. Okay, so this is something that is useful in the light log case. In this other case, you are trying to move your generator in such a way that this function, that is the sum of all the cubes of the areas of each single region, is minimized. Okay, I will show you why. Now, just looking at these equations, you see, so this is a function that is defined. You need to know the position of all the generators to compute this function. And here you need to compute, again, you need to know the position of all the generators to compute the Voronoi partition. Okay? However, computing the gradient of this can be done in a decentralized way, in the sense that you only need to know the position of your neighbors. Okay? You don't need to know about the position of everybody. Okay? Neighbors, of course, this is in the sense of the Delaunay graph, so there are some pathological cases. Okay. So we can prove that this is in the this is optimal in the light log case, and also locally recovers the performance of the best known algorithm, that is this one. Why is that? Essentially, the reason is the following. So let's say that you fix the generators in some arbitrary way, and you don't move them. Okay, then you look at the performance of the system, that is this expected waiting time. The expected waiting time can be computed, and it happens to be proportional to the sum of the cubes of all these areas. Okay, essentially it's the sum of the cubes of the probability of the next target landing in somebody's region. Okay,
this doesn't have regeneration.
This has regeneration.
So the Voronois are going to always change.
They will actually converge. They will converge. So the way you compute this, the generator for the Voronoi regions are for the Voronoi partition are associated to each agent. Okay, so the number of the generator does not change. Okay, but you want to move the position of the generators in such a way that you minimize some function.
Okay, it's the Voronoi for the agents, not
for
the
agent. Yeah, not for the target. That's very good. Yeah.
Is that the coordinate system for the agent, the Voronoi, this GI?
So, yeah, so essentially each agent has its own nest, okay? And will move around its nest in such a way that it, it identifies the region that is...
And GI is the kind of coordinate of the nest, within the nest.
Sorry?
I'm wondering what means the derivative with respect of the nest,
So this is the derivative partial with respect to
the GI is the coordinate of coordination.
The two coordination in the sense of
coordination
between
there,
yeah,
there.
Yeah, definitely. Okay.
Okay.
That's the position of the generator.
No, I got it.
So since you want to minimize, this function. So you want to minimize the sum of the cubes, but you know that the sum of all the individual. The areas of the individual region must be equal to one, or the area of your environment. So if you want to minimize this, really what happens is that you want all the areas to be the same. Okay? So you want each agent to have a region that has equal area. So it's a kind of like a fair allocation, fair load balancing. Then if you substitute 1 over n for this, then you get a performance that is essentially, notice that it is inversely proportional to the square of the number of agents. So now this is a very good motivation for having a large team, okay? Because I buy, twice as many airplanes, I get 4 times better performance, okay? This is a simulation, what happens. So this is what happens in the light load case. Notice that, so all the agents will move to the point that is called the median of this region. So this is something that's very similar to what Francesco showed a few days ago, right? So in this deployment problem. And the deployment problem, it's a static problem, and what the agents converge to is something that is called a centroidal Voronoi partition. Okay? Now this is not exactly a centroidal Voronoi partition, because the point of where they converge is actually the median, it's not the centroid. So it's a medianoid. I don't know how to call it. Okay.
So what's going on the right?
Let me finish this. So this is something that looks very much close to the coverage problem. But then you see that you also have some degree of reactiveness in this system, okay? Because as soon as one of the agents becomes busy, you know, going to service a target, then other agents will kind of move to cover the area that has been left open by the busy agents, okay? This is what goes on in the heavy load case. In the heavy load case, the target, so here, so what the agents would like to do is they want to partition the environment into sets of equal area, okay? And here already, the so the generators are these, you know, the yellow points are the nests, in a sense, okay? And they have already converged to some equilibrium solution, okay? And this is, even though it looks a little bit awkward, all the areas of all these regions are equalized in this configuration. And then what they do, okay, so it started again, so you see the virtual generator moving. Okay? And then you can actually prove that this has the you know, the same performance as the best known policy. Okay? Centralized policy,
so
but this is
generalized to a case where you have a trend in the distribution?
You can generalize it, yeah. So, but of course then what happens is that you don't want, really what you want to have is the measure of each one of these regions according to your probability distribution to be equalized. Okay, so if you have higher density in some part of the region, then you know this virtual generator would be more tight.
So when you said there's an advantage to having more, there's no penalty to sitting there and doing nothing. Is that what you're saying? No penalty for doing nothing.
That's correct. So okay, so this is the light load case. So there is no penalty for not doing for doing nothing. But actually, in the light load case, if you remember, the there was an equation that showed the performance that depends only on 1 over the square root of the number of agents. So really, in the light load case, the you know the motivation for having a large team is not that strong. I mean, it's not that great. But it's in the heavy load case, it is. Okay.
What's the spatial density that you use in the?
Oh, this is just uniform. All the simulation is always uniform density.
Then the converged regions look
awkward. They look awkward, but trust me that all the areas are very, very close, okay, to within, you know,
because if you're with
one part in 1,000
or something like that.
Sorry?
With a centroidal border tessellation, if your density is uniform, then you get fairly, you know, uniform.
Yeah, so
area distribution.
Voronoi tessellation would look better, but it not necessarily equalizes the areas. So there are many ways in which, so this is not like a unique equilibrium. So actually you can move, actually the minimum or kind of like even local minima are kind of flat. Okay, so I can move these points around and I will not change the areas. Okay, so that's why you get this kind of awkward configuration. Okay. Yes.
So for equal areas, isn't it much more time consuming to search all over those long, skinny areas than only the short, fat ones?
Yes and no. So all these results hold in the asymptotic case. In the asymptotic case where the number of targets is very, very large. Okay? So when you're, in any case, you're following a very, you know, twisted path, then you don't really care that in the, kind of in a larger scale that you're moving in one direction or another. Okay? So what really matters is what happens in your neighborhood. And so it doesn't really matter. So what really matters is the area of the set. Okay. But let me get, you know, we can get to something like that in a few minutes.
Okay, I'll wait.
Okay, so this was the solution of this problem for the holonomic case, in which I can just move in any direction as I please. Okay. This is not very realistic if you have elements. Now, if you have elements, then you are constrained and you cannot just turn on a dime. What you have to do is fly, for example, on paths with bounded curvature. Okay? So now what we have to do is compute optimal paths in the case where you have, for example, bounded curvature. Let's start with the heavy load case. In the heavy load, when you have lots of targets, it's kind of intuitive that the solution will have something to do with the traveling salesman, the solution of the traveling salesman problem for when you have bounded curvature. Of course, you're just putting more constraints. The empty hardness of the traveling salesman version for bounded curvature vehicles, the empty hardness of the traveling salesman problem for the bounded curvature vehicle is a consequence of the empty hardness of the Euclidean case. Something that we can do is any reasonable approximation, any reasonable algorithm will yield a cost or a tool which has a cost that grows linearly with M, okay, as long as the targets are generated in a compact set. Okay? But you know, this is not very nice, because if the cost increases linearly with the number of targets, then the average cost per target stays a constant. That means that if the target generation rate is high enough, then I might go unstable. Okay? So what we want to do here is the following. So we want to figure out if the cost of the target assessment problem with differential constraint increases sublinearly with the number of targets, and if so, can we find a polynomial time algorithm that gives us such a trajectory? Okay, so what is the difficulty? Let's start talking about the Euclidean traveling assessment problem. Okay, so in this case, it's one of the, you know, if you ever took any complexity, computational complexity class or something, combinatorial optimization, this is one of the prototypical hard problems. So this is what they tell you in school. So that is, the traveling assessment problem is very hard. But in practice, so the exact solution is very hard, but if you're happy enough with an arbitrarily good approximation in the Euclidean case, it actually turns out that it's very simple. So you can have polynomial time approximations that are very easy implemented. Then there is, this was the equation that I was looking for, okay, the one that defines this better. Furthermore, there is this result for the stochastic version of the traveling assessment problem that tells me that, okay, I might not be able to compute the tool, but I know how long it will be, okay? And this tool the length of this tool will satisfy this deterministic limit. Okay, so there is a wealth of knowledge on the traveling assessment problem. We don't know pretty much anything about the Dubitz traveling assessment problem, where Dubitz is this model of car with bounded curvature. First of all, it's a non-metric problem, and we know that the non-metric traveling assessment problem in general is not even approximable.
What do you mean by non-metric again?
So if you formulate the traveling assessment problem as a problem on a graph, then the problem is metric if your distances satisfy the triangle inequality on the graph. Okay. And in this case, this is not true. It's not metric, especially because there is no known reduction of this problem to a finite graph. Okay. So you really cannot apply any known method from combinatorial optimization. Okay? So you really have a problem that has this combinatorial discrete nature together with a differential nature, the differential aspect that is given by your non-holonomic constraints. Okay? And this is still like an open problem that is essentially something that appears in all UAV or airplane routing applications. What can we do with this? Well, let's start with the lower one. So in order to study lower bound, what we do is the following. We can construct what is called a small time reachable set for Dubin's vehicle. It's something that has this shape. So you have the vehicle starting at this point, heading in this direction. Okay, in small time can only reach points that are within this set. You will notice that this set does not include any neighborhood close to the origin. Okay, so this is something that implies that this system is not something is called small time locally controllable. But anyway, so if you do the calculations, it turns out that the area of the set reachable within time delta is proportional to delta cube, okay? Which means that the area of this reachable set is much smaller than the area of the set reachable, for example, by a holonomic vehicle. So if you can just move in any direction, then the area of the set will be just the area of a circle of radius delta. So it will be something proportional to delta squared. Anyway, so we can, given this the area of the set, we can compute what is the expected distance to the closest target, okay, given sample from a uniform distribution. This is the closest target at the initial time, where you have still all the targets to be visited. Okay? So then the distance to the closest target can only increase as time goes by. So we get a lower bound by just multiplying this by n times. And then this is the lower bound that we get. And you will notice that the lower bound depends on n to the power 2/3. Okay, so the lower bound is sublinear. Good news. Okay. Can we match it with an upper bound on an algorithm that achieves something, a dependency on n to the power 2/3? Well, what we do is something that is based on a nice geometric construction. And we define this shape that we call the bead, okay, for lack of a better word. And it's constructed this way. So imagine that the vehicle is starting at this point, heading in this direction. Okay? Then you build like a minimum turn radius circle here, another and then you want to end up at this point heading in this direction. And so you build another minimum turn radius circle here, and then you just, you know, fit another minimum turn radius circle in such a way that it's tangent to both, and then you build this the upper boundary of this set. You do the same thing in the for the lower boundary. Nice things about, okay. So what you have is the following. So if you start at this point with a horizontal heading, and you want to finish at this point with this horizontal heading, then you can always find a path that satisfies these boundary conditions, but also finds, you know, can visit any arbitrary point inside the bead, okay? So given any point here, there will be a trajectory, a feasible trajectory for my vehicle that stays within the bead, and such that the cost will be proportional to the length of the bead plus higher order terms. The width, notice that the bead is, the width of this figure is something that's proportional to the length of the region squared, okay? So as the length of this bead gets smaller and smaller, its width also gets smaller much faster. Another very nice feature of this shape is that it ties the plane. Okay, so this kind of gives the motivation for the algorithm. Essentially, the algorithm is very simple. So given a certain region, what you do is do this tying of the plane, and then just width the region by just visiting one bead in sequence, kind of like you're building kind of like a string of these beads. Okay? You know that you can pick one target from each one, and then you make a U-turn, and then follow the next row down, and you keep doing this until you cover the whole bar. Okay? Now, the problem with this is that since it's a random distribution, not necessarily you will have one target per bead. Okay? So there will be some beads that are empty, and some that have more than one. So you will have to essentially redo this a number of times. Okay, so I will not go into the details of that. I'll just show the results. So you can prove that, so we had this this lower bound that is matched by an upper bound which has the same form. Okay, so we have still this dependency on n to the power 2/3. We don't have such a nice result as that, that is a deterministic limit, but we can have a lower and upper bound and that are fairly tight. Okay, we'll not discuss the proof. So this is an example of how this path would look like. These are results of some experiments. So we have the lower bound, the upper bound. Simulation results kind of agree with it. I have to confess that really the slope of this is not what I expect. But you know, I know that there are some bugs because sometimes this Pac-Man starts making some turns. Okay, I haven't figured out the reason for that. And you know, here, if you notice, I run simulations up to you know million points. And you know it's kind of hard to track down the bug when doing this random parts.
He makes turns inside the region.
He kind of makes like a stupid thing. I mean, that's not what he's supposed to do. And it's, the stupidity is on my part. That yeah. I mean, my problem is has some bugs yet that I have not been able to find.
What is the slope of the envelopes?
Sorry.
What is the slope of the envelopes?
2/3, right? So that's the you know. So the slope of the envelope is 2/3. If you like a fit a curve to this one, you get a slope of 7/8. It is not quite what I expect. You know, I mean, one reason is that this will flatten out eventually. But already running a simulation with 1 million points with a problem that is harder than the Tarvin Seisman problem is already a little bit of a challenge. I mean, it doesn't take that long, but in order to get, you know, significant extension, this should get into the billions, and that's more than my computer can handle. No, so the numerical experiments find a solution given this algorithm, right? And then this algorithm will have a performance that is within a constant of what I know has to be the optimum, okay? Okay? So it will be a constant from the lower bound. I know that the optimal solution will not be lower than the red curve. Okay, so I'm not too far off. Oh man, very late. So you can extend this to the dynamic case as well, and you do it again in a residualism fashion. The simplest thing to do is just you know, take a snapshot, time zero, compute a tour through all the points. When you're done, take another snapshot and compute a tour through all the points. If you do the calculation, it's very simple to get that now the this expected time is something that grows with lambda squared, okay? Which is kind of intuitive because you're putting more constraints and now the dependency, your sensitivity on the target generation rate is on the square, goes with the second power. Whereas in the previous case was just linear with lambda. Okay, so this is a nice result that shows that you can ensure stability in the stochastic case, even for with a vehicle with this differential non-harmonic constraints. You have a stronger dependency on lambda, but unlike in the notice that this is not as obvious as in the Euclidean case, because in this case you can actually, if you place targets in an adversarial way, you can destabilize the system. Okay, but in the stochastic case, you can always stabilize it. How do we extend this to the multiple vehicle case? Notice how we wrote this at the upper bound. The upper bound has a term that is this thing in the blue ellipse. That is something that, so W and H are respectively the width and the height of a rectangular region in which you're sampling targets, okay? So this is something that relates to the area of your region. So that that amounts to essentially how many targets are just appearing in your region, okay? Then you have this other term, which is something that I see as the penalty associated with the non-harmonic constraints and the fact that your system is not locally controllable. And this is something that has, okay, it's proportional to your turning radius. So the bigger the turning radius, of course, the bigger the penalty that you would have. But you know, really what is important is the ratio of this turning radius over the maximum of either the width or the height. Okay? So it's much easier. Essentially what you want to do is you want to minimize the number of U-turns. U-turns are expensive because they take more than 2π, and you're not getting anything to it. Okay? So you want to reduce the number of those. So the way you reduce the number of those with keeping the area constant is by having a very thin and long rectangle, right? So essentially what you want to do is you want to make, keeping the product constant, you want to maximize one of these, okay? And then align all your paths with that direction. So if you have M vehicles, M edges, then what you would like to do is not have a nice centroidal kind of balanced, nice looking, partition, but what you would like to have is you want to partition the whole environment into a bunch of strips that are very long and thin. Okay? And if you do this, essentially the width remains unchanged, but the height gets much smaller. Okay? So if you do a calculation, you will notice that now when you have N vehicles, your performance will be inversely proportional to the cube of the number of agents. Okay? So in this case, okay, you're more sensitive to the target generation rate, okay, but you're also much more sensitive to the number of agents that you have. Okay, so now all of a sudden you have an even stronger motivation to buy more agents. Okay, buy twice as many, you get 8 times the performance. Okay, now this is something that is kind of interesting because it's something that is very easy to do if you have man-made systems. Okay, so let's decide that we orient, that everybody has a region that is aligned, say, with the east-west direction, okay? And then you do your calculation, that's very easy. But let's say that you have a biological system and you have animals that want to share their territory in a way that resembles this kind of partition. This is something that is hard to do because, especially when you have a very thin and long region, you might be eating stuff in one side of the region and then the other side of the region is kilometers from you. So how do you defend the territory? How do you let other animals know that you are there? What this makes me think of is that really what you might want to have is just have all of your individuals to proceed in a parallel direction, okay, and then sweep the area in a sequence of parallel sweeps, okay. So this is something that resembles, in a sense, swarming, okay, but even though not in a very rigorous way. But let's look at some of the implications for biology that I, as an engineer, can think of. So now I had theorems up to this point, and now I'm really in kind of like unfamiliar territory for me. I won't say too many stupid things. Let's look at the case in which you have several holonomic agents, okay? And then what you do is you have all the agents use a greedy strategy. And this is what happens, okay? So what you have is that the dimension, so if you look at the convex hull of the positions of all your agents, that's something that goes to zero. So in a sense, you have this swarming, this aggregation that is not driven by inter-agent interaction, they're just going for the food, okay? But essentially what happens is that becomes likely that they after the same item, okay, after the same particle. Is this a good thing to do? Well, kind of. You know, everybody will get their own fair share, but they will have to run much more for it, right? Because if they're in a group and they're after the same piece of food, one of the animals will get the food, the other one will have to wait for the next one. Okay, so it's not very efficient. So a better thing that you might want to do is something else, something that we call this Voronoi nearest neighbor policy. So what you do in this policy is the following. Okay, so you might want to go after the nearest neighbor, but only if you're also the nearest agent to that target. Okay. The reason for that is the following, that if you are the nearest agent, you are guaranteed to get it. Okay. Otherwise, somebody else might get it before you. So we can can just look at this like a small game where you have two agents. One of them is using this nearest neighbor strategy, the greedy strategy, and the other one is using this smarter, you know, like a little bit more clever strategy of limiting itself to its own Voronoi region. What you have is, in the case in which both are greedy, everybody gets their own fair share, okay? But it's kind of like energy inefficient. Now, one of them switches to a Voronoi strategy. And now what will happen is that the agent with the Voronoi strategy will get to eat strictly more than the other agent, okay? So this one will get more food, and this one will get, you know, the other one will get less. Okay? So then it's a benefit of the other agent also to adopt a territorial strategy. Okay? So it was very non-rigorous argument. You can think of this as a pure strategy, as a Nash equilibrium. Okay? So it's something that will be, again, a conjecture. This is some evolutionary stable strategy. Okay. So again, here they get each gets their own fair share, but the energy efficiency is much better. Okay. So this is in the this is a simulation of something that is very close. So you see that now what we're doing is we don't have a nest, so it's not in a sense a really territorial strategy, but it's something which the agents try to stay away from others, okay, and only pursue targets that are close to them, okay, so and others cannot get. Okay, and actually it turns out that even though we don't have a proof for this, the performance of this very simple strategy is the same, is no worse than the performance with the virtual generator that I showed before. Okay, so this is for holonomic agents. What happens when you have non-holonomic agents? This is a simulation of what happens. So now they have bounded curvature. When they have bounded curvature, you don't see that this collapse. Why is that? The reason for that is that, you know, remember that the reachable sets vanish close to the origin. So the area of the intersection of any two of these reachable sets of two agents is very small. Actually, it vanishes, okay, no matter what the positions are. Okay? So essentially, the reason for the inefficiency of the grid strategy in the holonomic case disappears in the non-holonomic case. Okay? So essentially, what happens in this if the target density is high enough that the average distance between targets is much smaller than the turning radius, then a grid strategy is actually very efficient. Okay? Very simple to implement, very efficient. And you know, can all of this have any implication for you know, understanding feeding, territoriality, and you know, swarming behavior in biological systems? This, I don't know, this is something that I'm very interested in finding out. It's challenging, but it's a nice problem. Okay, well, I will not talk about the light load case. I think that...
a quick question about the previous slide. So are you saying that it's just very much less likely that they will get stuck together, or that if you start with them arbitrarily close together, they will, that configuration is unstable?
That configuration is unstable. So both are equal. Essentially what happens, if they're exactly at the same configuration, then of course they will stay together, okay? But as soon as you introduce a small perturbation, then they will diverge, okay?
If you do not allow any other questions after your talk, you can carry on another 5 minutes.
Well, I think we would like to have some questions. Okay, so let me show quickly. This is just what happens in the light load case. Light load case, we have, remember that this vehicle cannot stop, okay?
So the best algorithm that we're able to come up with is something that is as follows. Essentially what you do is you want to follow these what we call loitering patterns. Okay? The loitering patterns, interestingly enough, are not, so they're centered at the median, but they're not minimum turn radius, minimum turn radius circles around the median. Actually, the best choice that you can have for these, at least for like a worst case situation, is use a loitering circle with a radius that is about three times the, your minimum turning radius, okay? So that makes getting to points that are actually inside your loitering circle less expensive. And actually we can do, so we have an upper bound, this is a lower bound, this is the performance of our policy, and we see that it kind of becomes, you know, closer and closer to optimal when the distance to the target gets larger and larger, but also in the case in which the targets are very close, does well with respect to the worst case. Okay, well, we have some simulation results here. I will not show them. I think that I will just, so many other. Something else I would like to show is that just this animation. So this is something related to, you know, the ants moving in trails. Problem that Jan, I think, showed a few days ago. So here I'm still studying the following problem. Let's say that I have a bunch of agents that, these are robots, that want to go from some place in this environment to some other place, okay? But they don't want to crash into other agents, okay? Very reasonable request. And what I want to do is I want to figure out what is the minimum time in which I can move everybody around and deliver, make sure that everybody gets to its own destination. It turns out that it's not optimal. This is a constant factor approximation of the optimal is a policy. Okay, so this is just the end. So let's wait for it to start again. So this is something that is called z-traversals in computer science. But I will call it commuter traffic, right? So you get up in the morning, take some surface street, go to the freeway. Then you get on the freeway, drive towards your work location. Then when you get close to work, you get off the freeway again on the surface street and go to your office and then repeat the next day, right? And this turns out to be an optimal, almost optimal routing strategy when you have these independent agents. And you know, this is also something that resembles very much this, you know, these ants organizing themselves in trails with different directions. So this you know, reminded me of this result. Okay, so this is something. So we have seen a bunch of, you know, several talks on, you know, getting agents to move in a synchronized circular formation. We are also interested in doing something like this, but again, I want to have like a specific purpose in mind. So what I'm proposing this for is this class of problems that are called path coverage. Essentially, path coverage, you have a bunch of agents, each one of which has some sensor with a footprint, and you want to make sure that you compute paths for each one of these agents in such a way that essentially your sensor footprint covers the whole environment. And you want to do this in an efficient way. Applications, you know, we started, you know, thinking about this for minefield clearing. This is also something that is applicable for search and rescue. So for example, you want to look for somebody buried under, you know, like an avalanche or something, or for vacuuming or or painting or other applications. And so what you want to have is simple robots. Okay, you want to have minimal sensing and communication. No GPS, no pheromones or anything that leaves kind of like a marker of places where that you have already visited. Okay? And you want to be efficient and robust to navigation errors and also to failures. Okay, because the problem is, so think of minefield cleaning. A simple way of doing, okay, so you can do it with a very sophisticated robot that goes and disarms the mine. Or you can do it with a very cheap robot that just jumps on the mine and blows it up, right? Blowing itself off.
The Italian war strategy.
They actually did that. Well, I mean, it is said that the best way to go through a minefield is to run through it.
Yes.
Anyway, so the way we do it is by using something that's very similar to the cyclic pursuit algorithm, but the way we do it is not exactly pursuing your the next agent, but you know, if the next agent is there, I just go in a direction that is, as you know, towards my the next agent, but rotated by a certain angle. Okay, And then we can study what happens as you change this angle here. So if this angle is exactly pi over n, then you will convert to a circle, okay? With a radius that depends on initial conditions. If this angle is less than pi over n, you will converge to a point. And you know, this is the classic result in cyclic pursuit. If you just use zero, then you will converge to a point. If this angle is more, then you will get on a logarithmic spiral. Okay, so really what we want to have is this curve that is called the Archimedes spiral. That is something that has, you know, the distance between two branches of the spiral is a constant that is exactly equal to the radius of your sensor footprint. Okay, and we can see that this policy stabilizes all of my agents in such a configuration. What is nice is that if I can replay this, one of the agents actually dies. So you see that there is one agent that, you know, jumps on a mine at some point here and becomes black. Okay, you see that the other agents kind of very nicely readjust themselves and still get on an Archimedes spiral that still covers the whole environment, of course, aside from a small region here, depending on the initial conditions.
It's a very visible jitter in the overall image, from left to right, when one of the agents dies.
Yeah, because I think that the region is centered at the center of mass. So when one of the agents dies, then the whole thing is repositioned. So it's not a change in the position of the agents, it's a change in the reference frame, in a sense.
Okay. So this is a minimum distance coverage, is that what you're...
So what I'm doing is, each one of these vehicles has this sensor footprint, okay, the red disk, and I want to make sure that all my agents kind of like vacuum the whole room, okay, without leaving any spots, okay? And one way of doing it is by essentially having this Archimedes spiral.
So it's a minimum distance covered by all the agents?
Not necessarily the min... So this is a... I'm not sure this will be the minimum distance, okay? But this is something that is very efficient because... this way. I think it will be, it might be a minimum distance, but I'm not certain. What I'm certain of is that this is efficient, okay? Because essentially what you're doing is each agent, as they move, covers an area that has completely been unexplored by others, okay? So there is no redundancy, not walking over other people's paths, okay? So you might be able to reduce the distance if you just went, you know, just straight. And then you just did like one way that this is done is by following this path called like a Busterfeden path. You just move in one direction, then make a turn, then come back. You know, like the machines that prepare the ice rinks, like skating rinks. Zamboni pattern, right?
It's never the same area, isn't it? All the same distance.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. But then I see this is moving on a curve, so I'm not.
The longer you speak, the shorter the coffee break. Yeah.
Sorry for that.
Well, the problem is the corners, isn't it? It's the corners of the area. You have a square area you're trying to cover with a
So I'm assuming, so in this strategy, I don't have any obstacle in the environment. Of course, there might be some inefficiency here. But then, of course, if you have a circular environment, then the Busterfeden approach is not very, it's not very well matched to the shape of the environment. So this is, if you want to cover the whole plane, then this is a good strategy.
The reason I asked was because I just read a paper where a person proposes we use this strategy for sampling, and he shows that the distance covered is much more efficient than the other sampling strategies. But he's not trying to cover the entire area, just cover it with the best map of the underlying area using or something like that.
I think, you know, there are some nice advantages of this. You know, the main advantage for me is that you're very robust to navigation errors. So you're very robust to odometry. You don't need to have a GPS. Okay? And if somebody dies, you readjust very quickly and you get back to another spiral that has the right that is the right trajectory. Whereas if you just follow the Busterfeden approach, if one of the agents dies, then somebody has to go cover the area that has been left open by this agent that died. So for me, the nice feature of this is robustness.
Okay.
robustness to failure and robustness to navigation errors.
Excuse me, although this is a very interesting talk what you give right here, we have to allow our colleagues to have a coffee break. So are you ready?
Yeah, I think that
we had a lot of questions, so we thank the speaker.